G'day and welcome to Between the Lines. This is Tom Switzer, and as always, it's wonderful to have your company. Today, how to solve problems like Korea and Iran. The North and South are talking, but Washington is sending mixed messages about how to deal with a nuclear Pyongyang. Plus, Israel and Iran had a weekend of confrontation in and near Syria. It started with the shootdown of a drone and continued with the downing of a manned fighter jet. Now the tough talk is escalating. Korea and Iran with John Mearsheimer and John Bolton. So let's get started. What's your favourite movie? Mine is Groundhog Day. Remember that 1993 romantic comedy? Then put your little hand in
mine. There ain't no... Here's it. Groundhog Day! Get up and check that hog out there!
Ah, Groundhog Day. Now, that's the movie in which Bill Murray plays a TV reporter who's condemned to relive February 2 over and over again. Well, the standoff with North Korea reminds me a bit of Groundhog Day. Think about it. The North Koreans conduct nuclear or missile tests. The UN Security Council issues yet another resolution condemning Kim Jong-un's blatant violations of previous council resolutions. It sets out to impose yet another round of sanctions on the Hermit Kingdom. And President Trump and the international community, well, they use the strongest language to condemn the North Koreans' act of defiance, only to helplessly watch the Kim regime do it over and over again. So how do you solve a problem like Korea? Well, now is as good a time as any to review the Korean Peninsula and the prospects for an enduring peace. Last weekend, at the Korean Winter Olympic Games opening ceremony, the Koreans marched as one, both North and South. A united Korean flag, lipstick diplomacy, tantalising talk of diplomatic talks, a thaw in relations between the two Koreas. John Mearsheimer is Professor of Political Science and International Relations and author of a forthcoming book on the so-called rules-based liberal international order. He's also, full disclaimer, a dear friend and mentor, but I'll try to keep him on his toes and subject this leading realist to some scrutiny. John, welcome back to Between the Lines.
Thank you, Tom.
Why has North Korea developed a nuclear arsenal?
North Korea, like many countries in the world, including the United States, feel that they live in a dangerous threat environment, and nuclear weapons are the ultimate deterrent. If you're a country and you're worried about your survival over the long term, the best means of maximizing your prospects of survival are to have a nuclear deterrent. So it makes perfectly good sense from North Korea's point of view to have nuclear weapons and to keep them.
Yeah, but you'll often hear that the North Korean dictator, Kim Jong-un, he's crazy. Do you think he's crazy?
No, I think that he's actually quite rational. I'm not supporting the way he runs his country for 1 minute. I think it's deplorable. But in terms of his actual behavior, I think he is rational. And by the way, the U.S. intelligence community, in particular the Central Intelligence Agency, has come to the conclusion that he is a rational actor. From an American perspective, it may seem irrational that he is developing nuclear weapons, but that's simply because the United States doesn't want him to develop nuclear weapons. But from his point of view, it's a perfectly sensible thing to do.
Yeah, but he's certainly been playing with fire with these missile and nuclear tests, hasn't he? I mean, he's threatened to use an intercontinental ballistic missile to hit the US homeland. Surely he's playing with fire when he lobs these missiles across the Sea of Japan.
Just to be clear here, Joseph Stalin ran a regime that was probably even more ruthless than the regime that Kim Jong-un runs, and yet Joseph Stalin was a rational actor or a strategic calculator when it came to foreign policy. So just because you run an absolutely horrible regime at home doesn't mean that you're irrational. Now, I think that what Kim Jong-un and the North Koreans more generally are trying to do here is they're trying to develop a nuclear capability that can hit the United States, because they understand that once North Korea has the ability to hit the United States is highly unlikely to use its nuclear weapons to defend either South Korea or Japan. You want to remember that South Korea and Japan do not have nuclear weapons, and they depend on the American nuclear umbrella. That means the United States has to be free to use nuclear weapons for the defense of both South Korea and Japan. But it's extremely unlikely that the United States would use those weapons if North Korea could hit the United States. So from North Korea's point of view, it makes eminently good sense to develop missiles and nuclear weapons that can hit the continental United States. Again, this is not to say the United States is not going to be unhappy with this, because the United States is going to recoil at the idea that North Korea can hit the United States.
Let's put North Korea in a broader context. Henry Kissinger, the former Secretary of State, whom you know, he's long argued that it sometimes makes sense to put yourself in your adversary's shoes. In that regard, let's look at the world from Pyongyang's standpoint, John.
Well, I think that Kissinger is absolutely right. And I think the Americans and Western countries in general are not very good at putting themselves in other people's shoes. From the United States' perspective and from Australia's perspective, it would be best if North Korea did not have nuclear weapons. But from North Korea's perspective, it makes very good sense to have nuclear weapons. The North Koreans understand that if Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons, the United States would have never invaded. North Koreans understand that if Colonel Gaddafi had not given up his WMD programs and had developed WMD, he would not be 6 feet under now, that he'd still be alive. The fact is that if you're interested in surviving as a state, there is no better alternative than to have nuclear weapons. People should just ask themselves, why does Israel have nuclear weapons? Why does China have nuclear weapons? Why does the United States have nuclear weapons? And you see no evidence that those countries are interested in giving up their nuclear arsenal.
My guest is John Mearsheimer, the Distinguished Professor of International Relations at the University of Chicago. John, what about China's role here? Because, you know, you'll often hear from the likes of Donald Trump, our own Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, Foreign Minister Julie Bishop. They'll all too often say that Beijing has all the cards, it has the leverage, that Beijing can really coerce Pyongyang into giving up its nukes. Plausible?
Well, I think at first glance, that argument makes perfect sense. China is a huge country. North Korea is dependent on China for its economic survival. And given those simple facts, one would think that China has a huge amount of leverage over North Korea, and that China could get North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons, or if not give them up, at least stop all the saber rattling. However, that's not the case. And in fact, in this relationship, it's North Korea that has almost all the leverage over China. Now, why is that the case? China considers North Korea to be a very important piece of strategic real estate. North Korea really matters to China for its own defense. You want to remember that when the United States crossed the 38th parallel in the fall of 1950 and entered North Korea, the Chinese then came into the war. And the Americans fought the Chinese, not the North Koreans, from 1950 to 1953. And the reason that the Chinese came into the war when we crossed the 38th parallel is because we were heading up towards, we the Americans, were heading up towards the Yalu River, which is the North Korean-Chinese border. And the Chinese found it intolerable that the United States would be able to station forces on its border in North Korea. So they fought from 50 to 53 to defend the sovereignty of North Korea. And the Chinese have made it clear that they have no intention of letting North Korea fall apart and collapse and let it be conquered by South Korea with its American allies. So as long as the North Koreans understand that China is not going to let it collapse, the North Koreans can, in effect, ignore the Chinese when the Chinese tell them to stop saber rattling or tell them to give up their nuclear weapons.
So what you're saying here then, John, is that China, like all great powers, has a sphere of influence, and they will play hardball to protect vital interests in their near abroad. That's why they see North Korea as a strategic asset. I get that. But you're also one of the leading proponents of containing China's expanding sphere of influence into Asia, yet you cut them some slack on North Korea. Is there a disconnect here between your two positions?
No, because this is not a case of expanding. They've already expanded. They already have North Korea in their sphere of influence. and they have no intention of letting North Korea go down the tubes because their great fear is that South Korea and the Americans will then move in and fill that vacuum. So what's happening here is that China is trying to maintain the status quo. It's the Americans who are trying to change the status quo and trying to get China to do the heavy lifting. The Americans understand that they really have no cards to play vis-a-vis the North
Koreans. Yeah, but surely China's leaders have no interest in seeing how their communist comrades saber rattles. I mean, surely Beijing would like to replace Kim with someone who's more restrained in terms of his behavior, right? Because that only antagonizes Washington and it might force Japan to go nuclear.
I think there's no question about that. I think that the Chinese are worried that all of this saber rattling is going to push not only Japan, but South Korea to think about getting their own nuclear weapons, and they might very well do that. And furthermore, I think the Chinese are fully aware that there's a real danger that we'll get a war, not because either side is irrational, but because of miscalculation. This is a dangerous situation. The Chinese are worried about it, and they've been working hard to get Kim Jong-un to back off. But the problem is the Chinese do not have a lot of leverage. I think the Chinese would like to see Kim Jong-un replaced by some leader who is less bellicose, who's less into saber rattling. But the Chinese are not very good at regime change, just like we're not very good at fostering regime change.
So when all is said and done, John, is there any hope of getting the North Koreans to give up their nuclear program?
No. And in fact, the CIA has said there's no hope of getting the North Koreans to give up their nuclear weapons. Do you think there's any hope of getting the United States to give up its nuclear weapons?
No, although interestingly—
Do you think there's any hope of getting Israel to give up its nuclear weapons?
No, although interestingly, last year, one of these committees to disarm the world from nuclear weapons won the Nobel Peace Prize. So there's obviously a widespread appetite to disarm nuclear weapons around the world, right?
Yes, but those people have no influence. Therefore, it's all very interesting. It makes for nice newspaper stories. But in the real world, it just doesn't matter at all.
Yeah.
In case you hadn't noticed, the United States is going to invest $1 trillion in new nuclear weapons.
Indeed. Well, see, your line then is that the U.S. should just stop threatening regime change and try to work out some kind of agreement with Pyongyang. I understand that. But your critics, they'll say you're indulging in appeasement a la Neville Chamberlain via Hitler at Munich in 1938. How do you respond to critics who say that people like you, John, are appeasers?
First of all, what we did with the Soviet Union during the Cold War is we accepted the fact that they had a nuclear arsenal. As much as we disliked it, we accepted the fact that they had expansionist tendencies. And nevertheless, we adopted a containment policy. Was that appeasement? I don't remember anybody calling that appeasement. Why should a similar policy directed at North Korea be called appeasement? It's containment.
Washington is sending mixed messages. This week, the Vice President, Mike Pence, he said that the U.S. is ready to talk with North Korea. At the same time, the U.S. National Intelligence Director, Dan Coats, he warned that North Korea poses an existential threat to the U.S. Coates reflects the prevailing wisdom in the intelligence and the military establishment in Washington. It goes beyond the Trump administration, Republican and Democrat alike. Does all that contradict the new hope for closer relations between the two Koreas that we've seen over the last week since the opening ceremony?
Well, the Americans have this belief that you can keep what they call maximum pressure on North Korea. And at the same time, you can negotiate with them. You can engage in diplomacy. And the fact is that this doesn't work. If you're going to pursue diplomacy, you can't pursue maximum pressure. Because just think about those words, maximum pressure on North Korea, and you're threatening to attack them, then you give them very powerful incentives not to get rid of their nuclear weapons and indeed to acquire more nuclear weapons. If you want North Korea to move away from nuclear weapons, you have to have a rapprochement with North Korea. You have to take away the threat. Well, maximum pressure just threatens the North Koreans and gives them zero incentive to get rid of their nuclear
weapons. Okay, but for the time being, there's no attempt to work out a political settlement with North Korea. So what now? I mean, if there's no way to disarm North Korea, what do we do?
We're going to revert to containment, as we have for years now. There is no alternative. I would ask all of the critics of containment to please tell me what the alternative is. Do they want to launch a war against North Korea? I don't think Secretary of State Tillerson or Secretary of Defense Mattis thinks that's a good idea. The South Koreans certainly don't think that's a good idea. The Japanese don't think that's a good idea. So if war's off the table, you can't get the Chinese to do the heavy lifting, sanctions don't work, what are we going to do?
So your line then is that North Korea has become a nuclear state despite pressure, and that deterrence and containment is what you do when there's no way to disarm your enemy. But doesn't all of that contradict the notion of this rules-based liberal international order that we keep hearing about?
It does. That's, again, the way the world works. This is a world where realpolitik explains most of what's happening. And when you're talking about U.S.-North Korean relations or North Korean-South Koreans relations, rule-based international orders don't matter very much. It's just good old-fashioned realpolitik. And what's very discouraging to many people in the United States and into Australia is that the rules don't seem to apply here. And at the same time, we can't use force to solve this problem. And the problem just goes on and on. Going back to your point about the movie Groundhog Day.
But you're an outlier here. I mean, many scholars, journalists, politicians, they fret and wail that with Russia's incursion in Ukraine, China's expansion in the South China Sea, that rules-based international order is under severe strain and it's falling apart, and that Trump is complicating matters because he's not committed to that liberal rules-based order. How would you respond to all that?
Well, the rules-based order, the liberal international order, was in trouble before Donald Trump was elected. Donald Trump was elected in part because the people who had been running American foreign policy since the Cold War ended have done such a terrible job. And just to focus on China and Russia for a second, you want to remember that the goal of the liberal international order was to do everything possible to spread liberal democracy around the world and to pay very special attention to making both China and Russia liberal democracies. But the fact is that the United States helped pursue a series of policies towards both China and Russia, which failed to turn those countries into liberal democracies. And both of those countries are now authoritarian states, and they're growing more and more powerful, which is why we talk about moving from unipolarity to multipolarity. And when you move into a multipolar world where two out of the three states are not liberal democracies, there's no way you can talk about continuing the liberal international order.
John, we're out of time. Thanks so much for being on ABC Radio again.
My pleasure, Tom.
That was John Mearsheimer. He's Professor of Political Science and International Relations. He's also author of a forthcoming book on liberalism and nationalism. That's from Yale University Press.
Between the Lines with Tom Switzer.
And now to the tensions between Israel and Iran. Last weekend, the Israeli military shot down a drone they say was sent by the mullahs through Syria. In retaliation, Israel conducted military raids against Iranian targets. Syrian forces shot at the jet and it crashed just over the border back in northern Israel. And then that provoked even more bombing by the Jewish state in Syria. Now, for more on the Iranian threat, let's turn to John Bolton. He's a former US ambassador to the United Nations and now a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. John, welcome back to Between the Lines.
Glad to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Why would Tehran want to fly this drone inside Israel at this moment?
Well, I think it's a test. I think what has happened in the wake of the defeat of the ISIS territorial caliphate is that Iran's hand has been strengthened all across the Middle East, in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon. And I think they want to see, in light of this circumstance, what Israel's response would be. Would they shoot it down? Would they let it go? And I think, honestly, they're surprised at the strength of Israel's reaction. And it was quite a strong reaction, and I think appropriately so. This is a very serious moment in history to have Iran and Israel in a direct, albeit small, but a direct conflict like this.
You mentioned that Iran's hand has been strengthened across the Persian Gulf. Why do you think that's the case?
I think the way the Obama administration pursued the destruction of the ISIS caliphate played right into Iran's hands. I think it was a strategic miscalculation by Obama. I think by strengthening the military forces of the Baghdad government. We, in effect, strengthened the hand of the Tehran regime in Iraq, and obviously by allowing the Shia militia in Iran and regular Iraqi forces to meet up with the Assad military in Syria and the Hezbollah terrorists who had come out of Lebanon into Syria, now gives Iran at least a tentative arc of control reaching from their own territory right to the Mediterranean. And that is potentially a significant strategic shift. When you combine that with Iran's continued pursuit of nuclear weapons, it's very dangerous.
But you see, your critics, they might say that the US-led invasion of Iraq in 2003, 15 years ago, that inadvertently helped strengthen Iran's hand.
No, I think that's completely wrong. I mean, you would have to argue that every event that followed the invasion followed inevitably and unalterably and solely because of the invasion. And that's clearly wrong. The rise of Islamic radicalism, to the extent we've seen it beginning in 2001 with the 9/11 attack and continuing right down to the present day, really had absolutely nothing to do with the invasion of Iraq. And that probably has changed the Middle East as much as anything else. Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons had already begun. I'd be happy to debate the Iraq war again. We made a lot of mistakes, that's for sure. The biggest mistake was Obama's withdrawal of all American forces in 2011.
Vali Nasser from Johns Hopkins University in Washington, a former Richard Holbrooke advisor, he's been a guest on this program and he's written books on this subject. And he'd agree with you about Obama's premature withdrawal in 2011. But he'd also say, John, that regime change in Baghdad overturned the sectarian imbalance there that had been in place since the Ottomans. And it created, for the first time in history, a sectarian Shia regime that found favor with the mullahs in Tehran.
Well, I think what happened was that particularly after the withdrawal of American forces, the Ayatollahs were able to exploit the differences within the Shia community in Iraq. The population, the ethnic diversity of Iraq was such that most Shia did not want an Iran sympathetic regime in Baghdad. And when they were combined with the Sunni Kurds and the Sunni Arabs, the radical Shia loyal to Tehran were a very small percentage. But when we left, when the Kurds broke away, when the Sunnis in effect broke away and sided with ISIS, the resurgent al-Qaeda. At that point, it was only the Shia left under the control of the government of Iraq, and Tehran exploited it. So it was a tragic breakdown of the possibility of a secular Iraq. I think we would have left that to the Iraqis themselves. But the key cement in all that was the presence of American forces that held the disparate factions together. And when we left, not when we came in, but when we left, that was the opening that Tehran exploited.
My guest is John Bolton, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. He's also with the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. John, what about the role of Russia here in aiding and abetting this so-called Shia crescent?
Well, I think it's very significant and important. I think you have a de facto Russian-Iranian alliance. The alliance is critical to the support of the Assad regime in Syria, which Russia wants for its naval base at Tartus and its new air force base at Latakia. Both Iran and Russia are propping up the Assad regime. They have lots of common interest in coordinating their petroleum and natural gas prices, putting their thumb in the eye of the United States. And it's a real danger to international peace and security in the Middle East. You know, the Russians are more present now there than at any time since the early 1970s, when Anwar Sadat tossed out the Soviet military advisors, brought Egypt into the Western orbit, and entered into talks with Israel that led to the Camp David peace accord. Now they're back, and the Russians are back and aligned with the most destabilizing power in the region, Iran. And I think it portends the potential for a lot more instability, a lot more trouble.
I think May 12 is the deadline for the Americans to decide on the Iranian sanctions waiver. If Washington effectively kills the Iranian nuclear deal, what's the most likely consequence?
Well, I think the most likely consequence is we've returned to the possibility of stopping Iran from getting nuclear weapons. This deal is a strategic blunder for the United States, it was the worst agreement, the worst act of diplomatic appeasement, I think, in American history. I certainly hope the president abrogates the deal. He's said enough critical things of the deal that it'd be very hard for him, I think, to maintain those beliefs and stay in the deal. We'll see in May. But honestly, I think the real danger point now is far from the Middle East. It's in North Korea. Because if North Korea, which is very close to getting worldwide deliverable nuclear weapons, achieves that capability, they will be able to sell to Iran and anyone else with hard cash all of their technology. So whether Iran's in violation of the JCPOA or not, whatever North Korea has, Iran can have the next day.
Well, I've just been chatting with Professor John Mearsheimer from the University of Chicago, and he suggests that Washington can contain and deter threats such as Iran and North Korea. And his argument, John, is that if we could contain Mao Zedong and Uncle Joe Stalin at the height of the Cold War, why can't we keep the mullahs and the Kim regime in their box?
Well, the Chinese didn't have really very much of a nuclear capability at all. They made France and Britain look like great nuclear powers. And we deterred the Soviet Union, I think, through a combination of factors that are simply not present, looking at the bizarre regime of North Korea, the world's only communist hereditary dictatorship, and the radical, indeed close to fanatical religious leaders in Tehran. I don't want to go back to the world of mutual assured destruction. I don't want to count on the rationality of the likes of the Ayatollahs or the Kim family. That's one good reason why the Cold War analogy doesn't hold. But the other reason is that fundamentally in the Cold War, it was a bilateral nuclear standoff. There were other nuclear powers, but there were only two that really made any difference. In the world we're looking at now with North Korea, with Iran, potentially with other states, we've already got Pakistan and India and Israel, you're in a multipolar nuclear world. And anybody who tells you that the calculus of a bipolar nuclear deterrence capability applies in a multipolar nuclear world doesn't know what they're talking about. We've never lived in such a world. I don't want to experiment with it.
One final question, though. Realists such as Mearsheimer will argue that North Korea and Iran want the nuclear programs primarily because of people like you, John. This is what they'd say. And they'd say that from Tehran and Pyongyang's perspective, they see nuclear weapons as the ultimate deterrent to a foreign attack.
Well, that gives me a lot more credit than I do, although I'm happy to get the recognition, I can tell you. Look, North Korea has never given up the objective of subjugating South Korea. And I think one of the first things North Korea will do when it really does get unequivocally the capability to drop thermonuclear warheads anywhere on the world will be to try and blackmail the United States to pull our troops out of South Korea, leaving the South more vulnerable. I think Iran has designs for political hegemony within the Middle East and the great conflict between Persians and Arabs. I think it wants dominance within Islam and the great conflict between Shia and Sunni. I think it has all kinds of imperialistic objectives on its own, which we have just been talking about in the spread of its arc of control from Iran through to the Mediterranean. So this notion that the poor North Koreans and the poor Iranians are simply protecting themselves from the imperialistic United States is about what I'd expect from the likes of Professor Mearsheimer.
John, as always, it's great to have you on Between the Lines.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be with you.
It's John Bolton from the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. Thanks for your company on Between the Lines this week. I'm Tom Switzer. Hope you can tune in again next week.